On the laundry list of the big questions facing humankind, somewhere near the top of the list is the question, what is life and how did it come to be? Astrobiologists and astronomers are working on that one now, and the search for life-supporting planets should hold some big clues to the answer. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm keeping you company today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Dimitar Sosolov. He's a professor of astronomy at Harvard University and founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. His new book is called The Life of Super Earths: How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. And we always welcome your questions and comments as well. How excited would you be about finding life on a planet outside our solar system, even if it was a microbe or two? And what do you want to know about how life works? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also join us on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickard Show. And Dimitar Sosolov, it's great to have you with us today.
Good morning. It's great to join you. Thank you.
Well, going back several years now, there have been alerts now and then that scientists have found a planet outside our solar system. I guess they're called exoplanets now, and that some of these planets could potentially support life. Now, can you explain the excitement? What would it mean finding an exoplanet like that?
The past few years have been a real explosion of research and discoveries in this new field, finding planets orbiting other stars, exoplanets, as we call them for short. It's a final and holy grail goal of this research is finding a planet that is similar to our planet Earth. And we haven't achieved that yet, but a lot of milestones along the way have been accomplished already.
Well, I gather one of the most exciting now seems to be a planet called Kepler-22b. What do you know about that one?
That one is the first planet of relatively small size, just about two and a half times larger in size than our Earth, which resides in what we call the habitable zone of its star. That's a distance from the star, not unlike our own orbit of planet Earth, where the temperature is moderate and where water could be liquid anywhere on the surface.
So what else does it take to support life? You mentioned water. What else do we need?
That's a very deep question. And the reason it is Veronica, we actually don't have a good definition of life that all scientists agree on, or we don't understand the real nature of the phenomenon we call life. So basically what I try to describe in my book is that if you start from the basics, understanding that life is essentially a phenomenon of chemistry, of chemical bonds and large molecules, then you could say, well, what are the environments out there in the universe at large where this kind of chemistry could happen? And so planets like Earth with rocky surfaces, but also solvents, and water is a very good solvent, seem to be one of the few places in the universe at large where this could happen.
So does a planet like that also have to have, I guess, solid ground? You mentioned a lot in the book having a rocky planet, I guess, so that it has some sort of tectonic activity. There's no way you're going to find life or a microbe on one of these gaseous planets, is there?
That's, again, a question which comes back to our lack of understanding of a general view of life. We actually don't know, to be honest, but one thing we do know is that if you have a planet which is mostly gaseous, where many layers upon layers of gas like hydrogen and helium represent what is indeed the outside surface of the planet. There is no solid surface anywhere. You have an environment which may contain all the elements that are necessary for life, the chemistry of life, but they are very dilute. They are in a way in which they cannot combine and form those large molecules and complex networks that we think are required for life to emerge. So that's why we astronomers are striving to find planets that are smaller, rocky, have some water, maybe a lot of water too, but not really gas like hydrogen and helium.
I wonder if you could flesh out a little for us what's at stake here. I know there's the intellectual inquiry about what constitutes life, and also from time to time, we are reminded that the planet we are living on will eventually be consumed by the sun, and life will be impossible on Earth. And so are we looking for a planet that will be an escape hatch, so to speak, or are we just trying to find out what it is life is?
Ultimately, that's probably the direction in which we are going. We are thinking about other places beyond Earth. But in a certain sense, what we really have here is a system which is, because it's basically chemical, is within the reach of understanding and understanding here on Earth in our lab. So what compelled me to write this book is really the convergence of these two seemingly unrelated game changers in modern science. One of them is understanding the natural environments for those that chemistry, and we talked about that, the different types of planets and our own in that big picture. But the second one is very important. That is really game-changing development from biology, and particularly from chemical synthetic biology, which is our ability to build the functionalities of life from the individual molecular component in the lab, and hence hopefully understand what life is, what the nature of the phenomenon is. If we are able to do that, we will enhance our own experience here on our planet, and ultimately we will understand how to go into the future. So in a sense, that will tell us what happens when Earth is no longer a planet around a benign star. Our sun eventually is going to retire, and stars tend to retire by blowing off much of their matter. And that's not the good news for a planet.
So how would life change here on Earth? You mentioned that as being one of the things that would happen. What would change?
On the short term, while the sun is still a benign star for the next 3-5 billion years, in the short term, our understanding of synthetic biology could be a game changer for our life on Earth, because it is that kind of synthetic tool that humankind developed about 100 years ago with organic chemistry, and which led to the ability to synthesize a lot of materials, for example. We use them every day, the plastics, the way in which we can produce medicines, and to really have control over the everyday environment of our own lives. Now imagine that you are able to produce materials which have the functionalities of life, that is, they're self-adapting, they're self-sustaining, they have a code which remembers what they're supposed to do and where they're supposed to be. This is the kind of materials of the future that synthetic biology could, in principle, bring to us.
It's interesting to see that coming together with the world of astronomy. They seem like they're such different pursuits, the chem lab and the guy at the telescope or girl at the telescope.
This is what is really fascinating about this, isn't it? Again, that confluence of human science and knowledge that was so separate before. To some extent, even our language has difficulty describing that, because we always thought of life as something completely separate, unrelated to the inanimate world. And now we understand that it's really all one, different ways of the inanimate world to move on and develop more complex chemistry. And back in terms of our science, that brings people from chemistry and biology and planetary science to really appreciate that and help each other. For us astronomers, of course, this helps us tune our ways in which we could search for life on other planets. For the biologists and the chemists, it turns out the information which we find out on those planets and the different conditions inform the ways in which they could synthesize some of the molecules in the lab. So we help each other, and that's actually, you mentioned in the beginning, the goal of our small team in the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative.
Well, I gather that it's much more likely that in our hunt for life-supporting planets, we will find a handful of microbes as opposed to, you know, some kind of complex life form that resembles an animal or even a little green man. It's hard to get as excited about microbes, isn't it?
I am very excited about them. They're nice. It's all a matter of practicality, really. Images of plants and animals are so interesting and pretty, but the truth is we are not going to those planets anytime soon. They're pretty far away. It's not Mars or Saturn even we are speaking of. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, in the meantime, we look at the history of our own planet and the history of life on it. And for most of that history, I would say for all of that history, our planet has been dominated by the microbes, by the cyanobacteria, by all those myriad of little one-celled creatures that are everywhere, in the atmosphere, in the oceans, on the surface, under the oceans, everywhere on this planet. And they produce a lot of gases. Some of them disperse in the atmosphere and actually stay there. So they have literally transformed the appearance of our planet Earth over the billions of years they've been here. So they make it possible to see that transformation from light years away. So if I'm practical about it and I want to achieve the goal of finding such biosignatures, as we call them, on a distant planet, I should be looking at the easiest way to do it, and that's really looking for those unusual gases that an atmosphere of a living planet would have.
Well, and you point out that humans have already been seeding the universe. We've gone to the moon. There's probably even microbes on Mars that we've left there.
That's true. Life is very resilient, and those little critters, the bacteria, form spores. We know that some of those spores are very resilient to radiation, to low and high temperature. In fact, we know that only recently we called them extremophiles. In the past, we didn't know and probably have sent some of them into space. In fact, that's a very active field of research nowadays, trying to understand in what ways microbes really survive under the harsh conditions of space and other planets. And in fact, there is even the XPRIZE for understanding how extremophile could survive on planet Mars today as we know it.
For a long time, one of the really, I guess, charismatic ideas in science was that the Earth was in this Goldilocks zone. And this has even been used as an argument for the proof of an intelligent designer that life exists at all, that here we are on planet Earth, that we have these complex organisms, and that it's a kind of a miracle that we're here. Is that still true, or are people distancing themselves from that?
Well, the evidence is showing more and more that this is not exactly true, that there are many planets that orbit other stars, and some of them are in the habitable zones of those stars. We are yet to find a planet just like the Earth in the habitable zone of another star, but it is just a matter of time. And particularly in the last couple of years, the space telescope NASA Kepler has managed to show that this is probably very common out there in our galaxy. So as a result of that, this question, are there places suitable for life out there, which is an astronomical question, is being turned to another question, which is really a biological question, which is how easy it is for simple forms of life to get going on a planet like this. So Kepler is essentially bringing about this historical shift from the question being astronomical to now it becoming really a biological question.
It sounds like if you just imagine the odds of finding another planet. The universe being so vast, the odds, I guess, are pretty good that we're going to find another Earth-like planet.
Well, the odds are pretty good, but we have to really go out and find out for ourselves. And that was really the goal, and still is the goal, of the NASA Kepler mission. It's been in the making for more than 10 years now. You see, the odds are indeed good. There are billions of, hundreds of billions of stars, and we now think that there are probably at least 100 or more million planets with habitable potential out there just in our own galaxy. But, you know, it's just in the lottery. You may have one in a million chance, and that can happen. So we didn't know until the evidence is coming. And once we have the evidence, we get to learn not only that the chances are good, which certainly helps, but we also know where to look for it. And frankly, I would like to know. I would like to meet, you know, our neighbors in life in our galaxy.
Even if it's just a microbe.
Yes, I think microbes are great. They're really in charge of this planet still. We think very highly of ourselves, but they're really masters of biochemistry, and they are very adaptive. You know, they don't have pretty faces, but...
So we're just renting it out from the microbes.
I think that's where we are.
Well, Dimitar Sasolov is our guest this hour. He's a professor of astronomy at Harvard University and the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. And the author of the book we're discussing this hour, it's called The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. And we want to know what you think. How excited are you about the prospect of finding life outside of our planet on one of these exoplanets outside our solar system? And are you curious about what exactly we mean by life? Can we create life in the lab as well? And what would that mean? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 12:30 today, join us for Chapter a Day as Norman Gilliland reads from The Tiger by John Valiant. In rural Russia, a tiger is killing people. Valiant brings the tiger, the people, and the conflict to life in this true story. This hour, we're talking with Dimitar Sasolov, a professor of astronomy at Harvard University and the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. His new book is called The Life of Super-Earths. And we'll go now to our first phone call. We have Earl joining us from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning, and thank you for doing this topic.
You're welcome.
And a wonderful job you have, Professor. I wanted to ask about the Viking mission, though. There's still some folks, including, I think, some scientists, that think Viking did find life in their experiments. Some others say it was due to chemicals, but they haven't been able to duplicate that kind of chemical reaction here on Earth. So there's still concerns about Viking. And also, why don't we have a mission going to Europa yet? That's another prime area right in our solar system for life.
Thank you for your question, Earl. This is great. I'm happy you're bringing up Viking, because this is one of the historically most exciting missions NASA has put together. It was in the 70s, landed on Mars. In fact, two large laboratory landers landed in two different locations on Mars, and it did. They both did chemical experiments, hoping to find signatures of existing life on the surface, and they came up with results which were puzzling in the beginning, and have since been satisfactorily explained by the unusual surface chemistry of Mars. However, scientists have definitely not given up on life on Mars. In fact, you and the listeners may notice that there is a very large new and upgraded life-searching laboratory going to Mars as we speak. It's the Mars Science Laboratory. It will land on Mars in August of this year. And this time, it's going to do two things which the previous laboratories, Vikings, didn't do. It's going to dig deeper. The Vikings really just took very superficial surface samples. And it's going to do experiments which now account for the unusual chemistry on the surface of Mars, which we've learned very well in the past few years with the Opportunity and Spirit rovers. Now, further afield in our own backyard here in the solar system, there is Europa. Of course, there is also the Saturn moons of Titan and Enceladus.
Europa is a moon, isn't it?
Yeah, all of these are moons. Europa is the moon of Jupiter. And all of these are being heated by tidal heat. They're further out, so it's cold when it comes to the solar heating. But because they're heated by internal flexure, being moons of a very large planet in both cases, all these moons have kind of chemistry which could be conducive to life. And particularly, Europa has an ocean. On top of that ocean, there is a crust of ice, but that's fine. You know, life could exist on the bottom. There's a lot of work being done now to design a mission that will go to Europa, funded by NASA. So I'll expect that in the next few years we'll hear more and we'll have something which will be getting ready to fly there.
Well, thank you for those questions, Earl. Those are great questions. And you brought up NASA. NASA, as we know, has been the victim of economic troubles, and they've been having trouble getting their ideas off the ground, so to speak, lately with the funding. How is that going to impact this sort of exploration?
Well, it's certainly impacting us in the sense that everything gets delayed. We're impatient and want to know more. I think the drive, though, and particularly across the entire administration at NASA, is that this is a big question. This is something for the history books, and we are going to do it sooner or later. The scientists want to do it. The public wants to do it. I'm quite optimistic that, despite the delays, we'll follow on with something on Kepler. NASA Kepler is going to achieve its goal in the next few years, and then we'll have a mission that is going to find all the nearby planets, and then we'll be able to study those. So NASA is, I believe, fully committed to that future exploration.
Well, let's move on to our next caller. Jonathan is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, and it's a pleasure being able to talk to a professor of astronomy. You know, I graduated college in 2009, and I went to my first astronomy club meeting with a friend of mine. And in that meeting, we talked about just the size of everything. And that's what, you know, it was kind of an awe moment to think how tiny we are. One of my biggest frustrations in getting into astronomy was technology doesn't move fast enough, and I want to be able to meet our neighbors, like you said, as fast as possible. I just wanted to know if that frustration that things aren't moving fast enough and technology doesn't progress enough goes from the amateur like myself all the way up to the Harvard professor.
Okay, interesting question.
Thank you, Jonathan. Yes, that frustration goes all the way to the Harvard professor. We're in the same, I'm fully with you on that. I want to be out there. And I think, you know, since you're talking about how big things are and space, I'm very excited about the recent developments in bringing all of us to space, in the ability for humans to really break that barrier, finally. That's something which I was dreaming about when I was a kid, and that was not a long time ago, but it seems like it took longer than we expected. And now with several mostly private enterprises, this may become a reality sooner than we think. So that's the first step, leaving the surface, going beyond the atmosphere and being in space for real. Then the next step, going and exploring the solar system. There are a lot of people who think that people on Mars is going to be sooner than we may think, and it may not be the way we expected, but it's technically possible. Going to the nearby stars, well, that requires new science and technology. One day it's going to happen.
Hmm. And Jonathan also mentioned his moment of awe in realizing how big the universe is. And I wonder for you, if you'd share with us what your moments of awe have been. I mean, you must be on the front lines of kind of the mind-bending stuff. What do you remember as your moments like that?
There are a lot of moments like that, yes. I actually vividly remember one, and I describe it in my book because it was a special moment in my own life when I was a teenager and I had my first telescope. It was this very unusual feeling of looking through my telescope on a very dark night at the regions in the Milky Way where I could see a lot of stars, but a lot of black in between them, the empty space. And I had read some books, so I kind of knew how far the stars were. And I had this really feeling of vertigo, almost as if I could fall into the image that I was looking through the telescope. It's very unusual. And then I became a professional astronomer. I would go to those observatories up on mountaintops, very dark sites, very big telescopes. And it would be the same. It's just the vastness of space is something which our brains are not yet equipped to ponder and to comprehend. So, as I say in my book, you have to use math, and that sounds like a big put-off. But I think once we get to space, once we get to fly to the moon and to the nearby planets in the solar system, that generation is going to finally have the grasp of what the largeness of space is and really feel it rather than just understand it with the use of math.
Hmm. Do you think that will be in our lifetime?
Yes, I'm getting ready to go. But, you know, it's like with everything. I think it's the generation that will be born into it, that will live with it, just like all those kids that were born with the internet. To them, the internet always existed, so they have a completely different way of thinking about it. So I think the same is with space. It will be really more visceral than just simply understanding it.
Well, and you mentioned the math and how that can be off-putting, but I guess math is how we know about the existence of some of these possible exoplanets we're talking about. It's all about kind of looking at the effects on the bodies around them.
Of course. Math is one of the most powerful tools humankind has and always had. It makes it possible for us to understand the incomprehensible sometimes and to build things, to actually make something new. So I am all for math.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Michael joins us from Bear Valley. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi. How are you? I've got little exoplanet app on my iPad, which is constantly updating me on all the Kepler discoveries. And as I was looking at some of the extreme sort of conditions that some of these planets must be in terms of their proximity to the stars they are circling, et cetera, I was wondering if the professor could talk just a little bit about the unusual, the extreme sort of conditions that biological forms might emerge in, and any correlations with examples on Earth where we're finding life forms at the bottom of the oceans and things of that sort. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. I have the same app on my iPhone, and you probably noticed this morning that our team and our Kepler team had a lot of new plans for you in the update from yesterday. Yes, that's a great question. So we find that a lot of planets with all kind of diverse conditions. In fact, that's one of the big news in the past couple of years is how diverse the small planets are, even more so than we could imagine. Some of them very hot, some of them very cold, others are a combination of both. They have very eccentric orbits, so they come very close, they get very, very hot, and then they move out for a few months, and they're very cold. And then there are planets which are just made up of unusual stuff like huge oceans or just dry, completely dry, but of unusual surfaces. So your question is good. What kind of life could possibly survive on some of those? Well, we know something about life surviving in extreme environments. As you mentioned, the extremophiles, as we call them, microbes mostly, that live here on our own planet. So let's start with the very hot ones. On a very hot planet, large molecules will have difficulty forming. And so there is a limit there, which you can't really cross, because you can't build a living system with just atoms or very simple molecules. So the way this works is that it's a combination of it being hot and whether you have a solvent. Like in Yellowstone, there are these extremophiles that actually live at temperatures which are higher than the temperature of boiling water. But they are also in water which is under pressure, so the water is actually not boiling. So that's one way in which life has adapted itself. Then there is another microbe which is extremely resilient to radiation. In fact, it was discovered by studying the water that circulates in nuclear reactors in the 50s and 60s. We know how it does it, and it's quite ingenious. It basically has a lot of Xerox copies of pieces of its own DNA all over the cell. So although the radiation breaks up those DNA molecules, it has so many copies of it that eventually it recovers. Now, this kind of microbe will survive on a planet which is close to its star and has no atmosphere and a magnetic field to shield it from the radiation. So we actually anticipate that life is very resilient, the same way it is here on planet Earth, and that some of those planets could surprise us. But the truth is that most of the planets that we are able to discover nowadays are the easy ones to discover. They are very close to their stars, and as a result of that, they're very hot. So we actually don't think that any of them are good targets for the search for life on other planets.
Well, thank you for that phone call, and let's move next to Dick calling from Bark River, Michigan. Hello, Dick.
Hi, I've got kind of a spin question. Okay, you know, in science now, it's an exponential acceleration of information, and I would like to ask the guest, people working, looking for SETI or whatever, and it's mostly probably bacterial. They're working in teams, and they're in, well, they have to be cautious in what they say, but would your guests say in these people's heart of hearts, it's almost a certainty there is much life in the universe? That's it.
Okay, Dick, so I think Dick is trying to say there, that most scientists maybe believe in their heart of hearts, that there is life just waiting for proof.
Yes, thank you, Dick. That's you asked two very interesting, made two very interesting points. But to answer your question about what scientists believe or really are motivated by, I would say, most of us, especially in the astronomy side, where we're leading in discovering those environments for life, both in the solar system and around other stars. We indeed are doing it because we are motivated by the opportunity that this is true, that life is ubiquitous, it's a natural phenomenon of complex chemistry, and we'll find it on other planets. The same way as many centuries ago, people found different plants and animals on other continents when they discovered them. So the mere fact that I'm spending so much of my waking hours working in that direction, I wouldn't be wasting my time if I could do something else. And I think that's true for many of my colleagues. We are truly excited about the opportunity. Now, a lot of us would debate whether in our relatively young universe, where planets were not forming until about 8-9 billion years ago, most of that life on other planets will be microbial rather than plants, animals, and even further technological civilizations? That's a difficult question, and that's a different question. So most of us would agree that it's worth looking for microbial life. Some of us may argue that intelligent life is a different question. But I'm personally very supportive of the search for signals, the SETI program. It's something which we should be doing. We put some resources into it, but most of the resources truly are going into the discovery of planets, the search for life on them, and the work we need to do in biology, which is actually some of the homework we haven't done.
Hmm.
And just to make a point that you touched upon, the exponential expansion of information and knowledge. Yes, that's true, but it has two sides. The exponential expansion has been mostly in our technology, our ability to do experiments, to do observations, and uncover new things, both in the macro world, new planets, as well as in biology, the ability to build and really map those very complex molecules of life. However, there is a second aspect to that, which is conceptual knowledge, new concepts, new ideas. I would argue that there the expansion has not been exponential. We're still struggling with conceptualizing the nature of life, and that has been for quite a long time now. So hopefully our technology, which is accelerating at a very high rate, is going to help us by the experiments we do in the labs and the observations we do with the telescopes to actually have a real conceptual breakthrough, to really learn something which we never knew about life and its place in the universe.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that question, Dick. And we'll take our second break now as we talk with Dimitar Sasalov, professor of astronomy at Harvard University and the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. His new book is called The Life of Super Earths. And we're curious to know what you think about all of this, about the hunt for life outside our solar system. And are you curious about the chemistry of it? And what are your, how optimistic are you about finding this life in whatever form as we look for it during our lifetime? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can always shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with Dimitar Sasalov and talking about his new book this hour. It's called The Life of Super Earths. He is a professor of astronomy at Harvard University and founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. And I think we've got an email here that dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about with that last caller. This is from Dan, who says, "You have talked about life, but I have been confused for years as to the definition of life. Aren't all things, plant, animal, and mineral, made up of atoms? And if so, are not all things connected?" What do you think, Dimitar?
That's a good question. Dan, I hope you get a hold of my book and read one of the chapters which discusses exactly the answer to your question. It's a big question. First, we really don't have a definition. I would admit in science we have still confused about the nature of life. We know life is made of atoms, of course, and even more so of a very specific set of molecules. We call them biomolecules. It's just a very specific set of molecules, which is one of the mysteries of life, why only those were chosen from the very rich set that chemistry offers. But then that's not all. It's not just a bunch of molecules piled together. It is the networks of chemical reactions that have developed between those molecules, which have several functions that are very important. One of them is that that whole system, whether it's encapsulated in some way into a cell or otherwise, can replicate itself. And the second part is that anything, including replication, requires energy. So that same system that can replicate itself has ways to extract energy from its environment, whether it's light from the sun or chemical energy or something of that sort. So these two things live together, form a cell or a whole a set of materials, and when we see it, we know it. We usually can recognize life by just exploring it and seeing how it behaves. But the truth is, apart from saying that it is a self-sustaining chemical system capable of evolving, we don't have a very good grasp on life and what it is exactly.
I guess that's why there's so much work to be done here to figure those very questions out.
Precisely. I mean, if we indeed are serious about looking for life on other planets, we can't foolishly assume that it will be a carbon copy of life here on Earth. Even life here on Earth, as Stephen Jay Gould used to tell us, could have developed in a different direction if you rewind the tape of history of life. So we have to do our homework. We have to actually go back to the lab and explore what is called the chemical landscape for other islands out there which have the same functions which we ascribe to life here on Earth. And maybe we'll discover that there is a universal law of chemistry which requires only those molecules and only those networks of chemical reactions to work together. That will be a major breakthrough in science, but we have to do it.
Do we expect that the processes of evolution will hold true on different planets?
The processes of evolution are really central to what we think life is, because otherwise any set of chemical reactions will eventually grind down to a halt, to kind of a thermodynamic low ground state in which nothing's happening, and it really degrades due to the external conditions. So there is no adaptability to the changing environment, and the environment always changes. The planet changes, the climate changes, the star that the planet orbits will change. There is no such thing as unchanging environment in this universe that we astronomers observe. So a chemical system that is capable of adaptation is the only one that would have those functionalities. And maybe that's, to some scientists, in fact, that's the essence of life, its capability of Darwinian evolution. And that actually is an essence which makes life a system with the potential for eternity.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
It's fascinating because, again, looking at it from the perspective of an astronomer, one who is studying the universe at large with stars, galaxies, planets, and everything in between, this is a very unusual a way in which ordinary matters comes together. Very unusual in the sense that it is really very robust if we take our own example here on Earth. But, you know, science is always limited when you only have one example. So it's very important for us to find a second one.
So it sounds as though we may not necessarily know what to expect for the life, but we maybe expect how it's going to behave, at least in certain ways.
That's right, Veronica, and that's why we have a fighting chance to do it in our lifetime, because one of the aspects of this behavior is that life is always moving atoms and molecules around, and one of that aspect is it emits certain gases which can accumulate in the atmosphere of a planet, and that's part of it being alive, of actually those chemical networks working. And so this is something which we've learned how to do very well in the past centuries. We call it remote sensing. We use subtle changes in the colors of the light that we can detect with our telescopes in order to tell the chemical makeup of very distant and faint objects, even at the edge of the universe. So that is, in fact, the technology that we plan to use to search for life on other planets, the gases in those atmospheres that we'll be able to study that way.
Let's see, we have time for another call here. Let's go to Keith joining us from Edgar. Hello, Keith.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have got a couple questions. I don't know if you have time for them, but first question is, when I grew up, there were only two kingdoms, animal and plant. As I understand, there's many more than that now, and my first question is, how many are there right now? My second question is, I know you were talking about what is life, but it does seem that all life, as we know it, seems to be RNA, DNA-based. And I'm wondering if that's kind of the way you're looking at it, or is that the way it is?
Thank you, Keith. Great questions. And they actually related. So let me start with the second one. I mentioned earlier that life on Earth uses biomolecules, as we call them, and a very limited set of biomolecules from the richness of the chemical landscape. And RNA and DNA are very important ones of those molecules that life uses. DNA, as we all know, carries our heritage and the heritage of each and every cell that is living. RNA has some of that, but it has a lot of messenger and other properties, control properties inside the cell. And indeed, there is no form of life known on this planet that we know of which does not use either RNA or DNA or both. So when I'm referring to searching for alternatives to life, or what I mean biochemistry, life based on a different chemistry on other planets, or even maybe on our own, this is one of the things which is meant by that. That is, genetic molecules which are not based on DNA and RNA. In fact, there are chemists who have shown in the past that there are alternatives to DNA which could do the same job. And they have been synthesized, and we actually work in our team with some of them. And that brings me to your first question, which was about our understanding of the different kingdoms of living creatures here on Earth. There is a relatively new understanding which is based on our ability to study DNA, and particularly the genetics, using based mostly on ribosomal DNA. But when you look at the genes of all living creatures, from microbes all the way to humans, you can put them on a map, and then there is a very fascinating structure that comes to life, excuse the pun, which is that life falls into three major groups, not two, plants and animals, but three, and most of them are really microbial life, as it turns out. One of them is that of the bacteria. Another one is that of the archaea, as they're called, where in the past archaea and bacteria were all thought to be the same. They all look like bacteria, for that matter, but genetically they're very different, and actually it turns out that they have some chemistry which they don't share, and is very specific to each one of them. Archaea are called like that because they appear to be historically very old forms of bacteria, although this is yet to be confirmed. And then there is the third one, which is called eukaryotes, or these are the ones which maybe microbes, but with nuclei in their cells. And we, humans, as part of the animals, and the plants for that matter, are a little tiny branch which is part of that third group. So it's basically bacteria, 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 microbes, 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 and then a little branch which has all the plants and animals on it. That's the new view of life on this planet.
That's so humbling.
It is, in a way, isn't it?
I guess that's a takeaway from this hour. We're not all that. The microbes have to get their share, too.
That's true.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Keith. And as we approach the end of the hour, we've got maybe a minute left, Dimitar. I wonder for you, what would be the holy grail of this hunt for life as you describe it now? What would you like to see accomplished in your lifetime?
I hope that we come to understand the nature of life, either by being able to understand it in our labs, which I think may happen very soon, or discovering it on Mars, somewhere else in the solar system, ultimately signs of life on other planets around other stars. I think this question has been out there for too long, unanswered. What is life? And I feel, and that compelled me to write this book, is that now is the moment. We finally reached that moment when we'll be able to tell.
Hmm.
And it's very fascinating and exciting to be living in this time.
Well, I hope you're right. It is fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Veronica. It was a pleasure for me, too.
Dimitar Sasalov, our guest this hour, professor of astronomy at Harvard University and the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. He's the author of The Life of Super-Earths, How the Hunt for Alien Worlds and Artificial Cells Will Revolutionize Life on Our Planet. Thank you to Cynthia Schuster for screening your phone calls, and to Cheryl Gasser as well, and to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.